Good morning. Once again, this series is dedicated by Dr. Eli and Sylvia Wolfson. Thank you very much. In memory of Aaron Moshe ben Chanoch Henoch, Figurisha bat Dov, Yosef ben Meir, and Zisa bat Yitzchak Tzvia Cohen. Shamashav and Aliyah. This is the third in our four-part series. The fourth one is scheduled, I think, for May, and it's kashrus and dental appliances. Please make sure, I think we already said everybody signed in, but Ryan, make sure you sign in also. Okay. I always believe in people... In people chiming in with questions at any point if anything is not clear. That's doubly so this morning because last night was a very late night, and therefore it's entirely possible that nothing will be clear this morning. So please make sure to interrupt as needed. The topic for today, braces, crowns, and mikvah, is, I think, probably a fairly esoteric topic for many people. Particularly, I see many males here, and males are not even used to thinking along these lines. It relates, generally speaking, to either one of two groups of people, right? Who is going to be most concerned about this question of chatzitza, interruptions when going to mikvah, realistically?
Women
who are going to mikvah and okay, I didn't think about the Chevra Kadisha one. That's an interesting question, actually, in its own right. I didn't even touch on that in the shir, but you're right. That's an interesting point. No, the other group is Gerim, right? It comes up for conversions. It also comes up for those who wish to go on to Harabayis, following the view that some suggest that there are places where one would be allowed to go on the Temple Mount. They still require a trip to the mikvah. And a trip to the mikvah doesn't just mean like a man does on Erev Rosh Hashanah, Erev Yom Kippur. It means a real halachic trip to the mikvah. So that even according to those who say that one is able to go in a certain spot, this issue is relevant as well. So it's relevant for those groups, and it's good for the dentist to be aware of the issues and to make proper recommendations for treatment as needed. So the way I wanted to break down the shir is to first talk about the sources that underlie the issues that are involved, and you can see on your sheets the first double-sided page has the sources that we're going to discuss, and then afterwards to move into the practical cases. And I gave you a table on the third side that lists different situations. Grounds for leniency, grounds for stringency, and then where possible, some sort of conclusion, as you'll see, and hopefully by the end that will be intelligible. But I make no promises. We begin with the first source, a pasuk in Sefer Vayikra, where we are told, "V'rachat b'mayim es kol besorau," that one who wants to become pure, one who has been a tamei, ritually impure, wants to become pure, is supposed to v'rachat b'mayim, bathe in water, wash in water, kol besorau, all of his flesh, his entire flesh. That's what the Torah tells us. In source number two, we get the Gemara's comment on that. Amr Chia Bar Ashi Amar Rav Shiurin Chatzitzin Umachitzin Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai. Rav makes a statement that Chatzitza, among other laws, is a law that dates back to Moshe at Har Sinai. And when we say Chatzitza, the word Chatzitza for our purposes simply means interruption. So an interruption in one's immersion between one's skin and the water is Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai. Now the phrase Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai is worthy of a set of shiurim in its own right, in terms of what that means. But for our purposes, halacha l'moshe misinai means this is a Jewish tradition that goes all the way back to the beginning, to biblical times, even though I can't point to a specific pasuk that will outline the details. So we just say, this goes back to Moshe at Har Sinai. That's the phrase, halacha l'moshe misinai. From a halachic standpoint, it has the same weight as something written explicitly and clearly in a pasuk. It's considered a de'oraisa. So Rav says, this is halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai, to which the Gemara says, what do you mean calling it halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai? It has a biblical verse. Chatzitzin de'oraisa ninhu. Chatzitza, the rules of interruptions, are actually biblical, meaning they're written in a text. Dichsiv, it's the pasuk we just quoted. V'rachatz b'mayim es kol besaro, he will wash his entire flesh. Shelo yehi davar chotzeitz bein besaro l'mayim, that nothing should interrupt between his flesh and the water. So therefore, it's not something that's just a tradition going back to Har Sinai, but actually it's explicit in the Torah, that you can't have anything interrupt your whole flesh has to be washed. So the Gemara, after some discussion, comes to the following conclusion. The law that traces to Har Sinai is regarding majority versus minority and makpid versus not makpid. Majority versus minority means that we distinguish between an interruption that covers the bulk of one's body and an interruption that covers only a small part of one's body. Meaning, from the biblical standpoint, it is only a chatzitza if, it's only an interruption if, it covers the majority of one's body. That's number one. And number two, makpid versus not makpid. Makpid means what? You care about it, right? It's very hard to put into a sentence, which is why I left it as makpid in the translations. It's not something that translates well in a sentence if every time you have to write, cares about it. But makpid, significant, but it's more than that, it's significant. It's something that you don't want there. That's really the key. The kepeda is when someone is upset by something. Makpid means you don't want it there. If something is on your skin, but you don't care that it's on your skin, then going back to halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai, it is not a chatzitza. It's not a problem of interruption. So the classic discussion that comes up, you have a house painter. The house painter gets paint all over himself. Does he care? No, that's part of life. He has paint on himself. Or the Gemara talks about a butcher who has stuff from the animals that gets on his skin. He doesn't care. That's the way he walks around all day long. That's something that someone is not makpid for. So on a biblical level, a chatzitza is only a problem if, number one, it covers the majority of oneself, and number two, one doesn't want it there. If it's only on the minority of one's skin, or if it's on the majority, but you're not makpid, it doesn't bother you, then it's not a chatzitza on a biblical level. That's a very, very important point that's going to have ramifications for us. And the Gemara continues to spell it out in a statement from Rabbi Yitzchak, Uvid Rabbi Yitzchak, Dam Rabbi Yitzchak, Devar Torah, biblically, Rubo umakbid alav chotzeitz, only if it is the majority of the surface, and you care about it being there, then it interrupts. Vishenu makbid alav eno chotzeitz, and if you don't care about it, then it's not going to interrupt. Vigazu, then the sages decreed, Al rubo she'eno makpid, mishum rubo hamakpid, v'amiyuto hamakpid, mishum rubo hamakpid. The sages then decreed that even if you don't care about it, if it covers the majority, then it is a chatzitza. And even if it's only the minority, but you care about it, it's still going to be a chatzitza. Which means that the only case that is not going to be a chatzitza is if it covers the minority of the surface, and you don't care that it's there. That's the key. You have to satisfy both conditions rabbinically. The Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, in source number 3, goes a step further. He writes, Ulechatchila lo titbol afilu bedvarm she'enam chotzitzim. The Rama is writing in the Ashkenazi portion of the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. He says, ideally, one should not go to mikvah even with something on one's skin which is not a chatzitza. Even if you have something that halachically is insignificant, gezera atu dvar machotzitzim, lest you immerse with a chatzitza. In practice, this is a stringency. This is something that is an added level. It's not something that's going to disqualify an immersion. Meaning, if someone goes to mikvah and then finds that they had something on their skin that did not qualify as a chatzitza, halachically, we're not going to make them dip again because of this Rama. He's simply saying, ideally, one should avoid having anything on one's skin when going into the mikvah. Okay. So we've said that there is a concept of chatzitza, of interruption. You shouldn't have anything on the surface of your body when you go into the mikvah, certainly if it's going to cover either the majority of the body or it's something that you wouldn't want there, that if you knew it was there, you would want it removed. However, there are several points that we need to define in order to apply this. Number one, we need to define on the body. Because at a certain point, things that are attached to the body become a part of the body. This has been discussed and debated over the centuries in terms of issues that have nothing to do with teeth. It comes up in terms of a glass eye. Does a glass eye need to be removed before someone is going to go to the mikvah? Bandages on wounds. What if someone has a scab? All sorts of questions come up about something that's on the surface of one's skin and is meant to be removed or is not meant to be removed. Is there medically? Is there aesthetically? All sorts of questions come up. What if hair is tangled up? What then? I had a shayla years ago. I was involved in a conversion, and the woman who was going to go to mikvah had cornrows that she intended to leave there always, very tightly braided hair. And she, as far as she was concerned, was going to leave them in for life. So does that need to be removed before one is going to go to mikvah? These questions of what is considered part of the body, that's one thing we need to define. A second point we need to define is makbid. When you say someone is upset by this, doesn't want it there. So how do you define wants it there and doesn't want it there? What if they want it there now, but they're planning on removing it? In the dental scenario, right, obvious cases present themselves. You have a temporary filling, but it's going to be removed. You're having a tooth implanted, but right now it's, let's say, the stage where there's an abutment that's put in and there's a cap that's screwed onto it, but that's going to come off when you're actually ready to put something on top of the abutment. So the question of makbid is a fundamental question as well. And then, third part that we have to define, that we have to deal with, is there may be parts of the body that aren't expected to be exposed to the water, right? A woman, when she goes to mikvah, as we're going to see, is not supposed to open her mouth in going to the mikvah. We'll talk about what that means, but the question arises: is there a need at all inside the mouth for that to be exposed to the water? Or if you're dealing with a case in which there's a tooth and there's a filling inside a tooth, let's say it's a temporary filling, and you're concerned, well, it's something you're going to want to remove. The inside of your tooth is never exposed to water. So, is that even an issue in the first place? You have something that's implanted in the gum. That's never exposed to water. Is that an issue? So those are the three areas we need to visit. The question of at what point does something become part of the body such that it's no longer considered a chatzitza at all? Number two, the question of what is makbid? And number three, the question of which parts of the body actually need to be exposed to water in the first place. Clear so far?
Yeah. What about even decay and broken down tooth material within the hole? That would also you'd want to remove because it's destroying your tooth.
Right. So that's going to have to be part of this. That'll have to be part of the cheshbon as well. That's true. Hey, there are all sorts of side questions that we will or won't get to. If you ask them, then we'll get to them. So just might want to make sure to point that out. There are all sorts of questions that come out of this. So first of all, at what point does something become part of the body? So we look at a halakha that on the face of it has nothing to do with dentistry. Source number four, dealing with a Shabbos issue. One of the malachos of Shabbos, one of the tasks I'm not allowed to perform, is that of tying a knot. What if I tie a temporary knot, not a permanent knot? So the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, writes, V'yesh omrim, some say, Shekol kesher she'eno asui lahatir ba'oso yom atzmo mikri shel kayama. Some define a permanent knot as a knot that's intended to remain in for the rest of the day, which is a very strict standard when it comes to Shabbos, because that means that even a knot that I'm going to tie in my shoes, that I intend to leave in all day long, is a permanent knot. That's one. Then on the other hand, you have an additional statement, V'yesh mekilin lomar da'ad shiv'a yamim lo mikri shel kayama. Some are lenient and say that up to 7 days it's not called a permanent knot, so I could tie a knot on Shabbos that will be for that day, and it'll be fine. As long as it isn't going to be in for 7 days, it's not called a permanent knot. So here's the funny thing. What we've done here is, regarding Shabbos, the strict view says it's permanent after a day. The lenient view says it's not permanent until 7 days. The stringency and leniency are flipped when you're dealing with mikvah, because the suggestion is that anything you intend to leave in long enough to be called shel kayama, to be called permanent, is no longer going to be called a chatzitza, an interruption on the body, because it's now part of the body. So therefore, I'd actually be happier if the standard was 1 day to define it as permanent, instead of saying a standard of 7 days. The Chalkas Yoav is one of the several halachic authorities who quote the 7 day view and say that after seven, if it's going to be left for 7 days, not after 7 days, if it's going to be left in for 7 days, it's already considered to be a part of the body. That's one view. A second view is brought by various halachic authorities, the Shaul Umeshiv, the Ksav Sofer, and they say 3 months. Also stemming from views regarding this Shabbos consideration. And then there's another view, also stemming from the Shabbos discussion, which says 6 months is the standard. So you have, surprise, multiple points of view about the timing of it. Now, I should note two things. Number one, a very interesting debate that comes into play here is, how do you count the timing? When you say it becomes permanent if it's meant to be in for 6 months, what does that mean? Should the timing be from the time when it's inserted, and therefore permanence is, it's intended to be there for 7 days, whatever it is, or should you count from the time when she's going to go to mikvah to say it has to be from then? Logically, which would you say?
Well, time of placement.
Time of placement, right? That's what I would have said logically, is that it's the time that it's placed into the mouth. Why not?
Because the hakpada only starts at the time of mikvah.
Because the hakpada only starts at the time of mikvah, but is that something that's might I argue that hakpada is really defined not based on when I go to mikvah, but my general state of mind about the thing that's being put in?
Not necessarily. You can have something at the back of the mouth that I don't care about, but in as much as it's mikvah, then I care.
So this is a very important point in defining hakpada. Hakpada is not about, is it an issue for me for mikvah? Because if I'm not makbid in general, then it's not a mikvah shayla. So hakpada won't be an issue for in terms of that.
Is hakpada for the person it's placed in, or the dentist who's putting it in?
We're going to come back to that. We're going to come back to the definition of makbid, and you'll see. It's a good question. Hold on to the question. The logical way to look at this is to say that it's based on the time that you put it in. It's considered permanent if you intend to leave it in for X period of time, however I define X. However, I believe it's Rav Eliyashiv who pointed out that this could lead to a rather bizarre situation, which is the woman is going to go to mikvah today and say, this is a permanent part of my body, but that day happens to be, let's say your standard is the 6 month standard. It's the most strict standard we have here. Okay, let's say the standard is a 6 month standard. She happens to be going to the mikvah a day before the 6 months end. So she's going to go to mikvah saying, this is a full part of my body, I don't consider it something to remove. And then the next day she's going to go to the dentist and have it pulled out. Right? That's what you could end up with. So because of that argument, there are halachic authorities who say, no, we actually require that at the time of mikvah, she plans for it to remain in for that period of time. Yes?
Isn't there a difference between what has to be removed and what can be removed? Meaning, the day before, it doesn't have to be removed the next day. You just have an appointment the next day.
Correct. So that's the argument in reverse. That's the answer to it. There's another point here. Rav Moshe Feinstein makes the point that timing really is an odd thing to consider here. It's not really about time. Well, the way we look at whether this is a part of one's body or not is not based on how long it's going to stay in, but do you ever expect to remove it or not? Timing shouldn't really matter. So there's some debate as to whether time is a consideration at all. Others point to a different standard, which I reference here in source number 5. I'm not giving you the full background on source number 5 because it's a bizarre case and would take us entirely afield. But take a look at Rav Moshe Issel. It says he's quoting the Mordechai from his compilation on the Laws of Nida. V'osan sheyeshlen kimin klios saros devukos zu bezu. Women who have some kind of braids in their hair where the hair is actually stuck together, v'sakana lahasiram, such that it would be dangerous to remove them. I can't envision a situation in which this is so, but what they're talking about is a supernatural consideration. If you look at the Ramah, you look at the Sars and the Mordechai, you'll see what I'm talking about. It was considered to be dangerous to unstick this hair from itself. Lo chaitzi, so it will not be considered an interruption. And the principle that we invoke is called haina revise. This is the way it grows. This is considered to be the natural growth of the hair, and it will remain that way for her whole life. The whole life not being a specific period of time, just that's what I'm saying. If you never intend to remove it, you wouldn't want to remove it. The point is that when we talk about chatzitza, we recognize that sometimes something does become attached to the body in such a way that it's intended to remain there forever. Now, granted that the hair case is not a case of something synthetic being attached, it's hair being stuck to hair. Nonetheless, halachic authorities apply it to cases where you put something in the hair as well. The earliest case that we find referenced with this had to do with some kind of a treatment for a scalp problem in which they would put a powder on the head. And if you washed out the powder, it would be extremely painful. There were all sorts of problems that came along with that. This goes back to the time of the Mordechai, about 800 years ago. So they say, well, the powder is an external entity. Nonetheless, you intend to leave that on your head. And therefore, it actually becomes a part of the body. So that's item number one here, is that at some stage, items do become part of the body. One of the ways in which this is applied, as we'll see, is the bracket for braces that are put onto one's teeth. Those are going to be left there for a couple of years. They're cemented on. There's no way in the world you're removing that yourself. It's not going to be removed at any random time. This is now part of the tooth for all intents and purposes. So that's one of the cases in which this comes up. But that's our first area. Then we have our second area. Yes?
Likely scenario, a side dentistry would be someone gets their ears pierced. They're not really part of the body, but you do intend on keeping them there for a long time.
Well, do you mean the piercing? Do you mean the thing that they put in to hold the hole open, the post?
It's it's not really part of the body. It could easily be removed. The person really doesn't want to remove.
Right. So I'm not prepared to speak about that case in particular today, but my understanding would be that would be a chatzitza problem because no one views that as part of their body, this temporary thing that's there to keep the hole open.
They want to keep it there, but right. After week 6 months, that's problematic.
Correct. My understanding is that when ears are pierced, they only need a post in for a brief period of time, and then afterwards the hole is going to close up, assuming that from time to time an earring is inserted. Right, that's generally 6 weeks. Okay, so then I could see it really becoming more of an issue if it's a 6 week thing. I'm not ready to speak to that issue, and I think there is room to argue for wanting to keep it in and saying that will. My gut is to say that would be a chatzitza. That would be my instinct.
Many times dentists will put in a medicated temporary filling in a tooth.
Yeah.
Decay or whatever.
Yep.
And when they take it out, they don't take the whole thing out, they leave part of it there. So
right.
Temporary all of a sudden became what you would call permanent.
Yeah. When we get to the practical cases, then I want you to bring that up again. Because right now I'm just giving the background on it, so we'll understand the terms that we're using when we talk about the practical ones. It's a good question. So that's our first area. Our second area is makbid and not makbid. What does that mean when you say the person cares about it, doesn't care about it? And here we come back to the question of, well, the dentist wants to remove it, the person wants to remove it himself. What are we talking about? Take a look at source number four, which tells us how you... number six, which tells us how you define makbid. V'im derech b'nei adam lif'amim lahakpid alav. If people normally care... People normally don't want such a thing in them or on them. Chotzeitz, then it interrupts. Afilum eina makpedes alav ata, even if she isn't makbid personally right now. Afilum eina makpedes alav la'olam, or she never is going to. If this is something that most people don't want on their skin, it is a chatzitza. Even if to her, it's irrelevant. That's number one. Number two, source number seven, the Shach, Rabbi Shabbos HaKohen, one of the principal commentators to the Code of Jewish Law, says, Ve'echa derov b'nei adam ein makpidin, if most people are not makpid, ve'hi makpedes, but she personally is makpid, kasav beis Yosef b'shem harambam v'tur dichotzeit. Rabbi Yosef Karo, who did not put this into his Shulchan Aruch, did quote the views of the Rambam Maimonides as well as the Tur to say it interrupts. So in other words, it's an interruption if most people care, and it's an interruption if she personally cares. Either way, it will constitute an interruption. The standard is both objective and subjective. However, there are three criteria to keep in mind as incentives to keep something on or in, and such that someone will be said to not be makbid. Even if normally people would be makbid, but now I'm going to say, no, this person is not. And this will touch on your question about the medicated filling as well. The first is where there's an incentive to keep it in. Sometimes, even though it's something that normally people would not want, and you would not want, you have an incentive to keep it in. An example of an incentive is beauty. Something that people attach to their skin because they believe it looks nice. So this comes up, for example, in a response of the Ramban, Nachmanides. I brought it in source number 8. He was asked about women who dye their hair. So the question was, is hair dye, because it's on the surface of the hair, is that going to constitute an interruption? And he writes, Nashim shesovos sarosan lenoi mistabra she'en chotzeis. Women who dye their hair for beauty, he says, logically it's not an interruption. Denoi hulahem, because they consider it to be beautiful. Ve'ena makpidos lasiro la'olam. And they never intend to remove it. Adarabba, just the opposite, he writes, chozos umachad. They keep renewing it. If they see that it's fading, they're going to put it back in. That's not considered to be machbit to remove. It's just the opposite. It's machbit to keep it in. To keep it in. He also has a separate discussion, as do others who do deal with this, whether a dye matters. Is it really on the surface? Is it absorbed? That's its own discussion. Sorry? Okay. But that's one. Included in the category of items for which there is an incentive to keep them in is where something is part of a healing process. You want to get better. In order to get better, or in order to protect the surface from pain, think of a temporary crown, for example, in order to keep a person from pain, they need this thing there. So on the one hand, you could say makbid, because you don't want it there. You really wouldn't have it there if not for the fact that it's keeping you from being in pain. On the other hand, because it's keeping you from being in pain, you don't want this thing removed. If someone came along and said, I'm going to do you a favor and take this thing out, you would say, don't you dare.
But it depends if the tooth has a nerve in it or doesn't have a nerve.
Correct. Correct. And that's how long it's going to vary. Yes, absolutely.
Still want it there.
I mean, there are other reasons to have it. We're going to talk about this. We're not anywhere close to being done. You'll be here a while. Another would be where removing it involves some danger to the person. That's an extreme case, but that's the case also. But that's number one. One is not said to be makbid if he has an incentive to keep it in. Number two, a second consideration is where you can't remove it personally, where you require a professional, right? So in many cases of dental attachments, these are things which, even if the person is makbid, the person says, every time I look in the mirror, I get annoyed looking at this. Nonetheless, they're out of luck, because they're going to need a dentist with a dentist's tools and solvents or whatever in order to remove it. So that's a second area where we may say, it's not makbid. You have an appointment, and at that appointment, it's going to come off. And until then, it's going to be in. A third is, and this I just touched on by saying appointment, where there's a set date for it to be removed. And here I go back to a case that's in the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch talks about a ring that a woman wears, which she keeps on all the time, except when she's making bread. When she's kneading dough, she takes off the ring. And the rule in the Shulchan Aruch, as quoted from the Rashba, is that that ring is a chatzitza, because she removes it all the time, whenever she's making dough. When does she make dough? Who knows? I mean, she'll make it maybe on Friday for Shabbos or Thursday night for Shabbos, but at any random time, she could end up making dough. So the Pisrei Tshuva is a commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, and the Pisrei Tshuva there, in this discussion, it's the beginning of Yeredeya Kuftzari Ches, quotes a work called the Zichron Yosef, who says that we will consider this to be a chatzitza if she removes it at brief intervals, but not if she removes it at long intervals. Well, how do you define brief and how do you define long? So Rav Moshe Feinstein said it's not actually about brief and long. And he says something which requires Rav Moshe to say it, but once he says it, you think, well, that's common sense. It just required him to formulate it. Take a look at source number 9. He challenges the idea that it's about brief or long, and he presents this solution. He says, "Sarich lomar, you have to say, de kavanaso lechaleg bein hakepeda lahasir bishas lisha she'ein lezez man katzuv de esher sheyizdamed la bechol yom begam balayla lachay nechshav bechol eis shehi makpedes de eni achol levat lo al meshech zman." He says you have to distinguish between, on the one hand, a case where one is makpid to remove the ring during kneading, the case I gave, where that can happen any time. Any given day, she may need to make bread. It could happen at night that she needs to make bread. So that she's always considered makbid. She doesn't want it on for kneading dough. On the other hand, you have a case where she doesn't remove it. Shakpeda lahasir hu rak lizman katsuv. She only will remove it at fixed times. De'ad zman hahu vaday lo tesalkenu. Until that time, she definitely is not removing it. He says it doesn't matter whether the time is a week from now, or a month from now, or a year from now. I said before, Rav Moshe doesn't like this whole time interval criterion. Rav Moshe says, if you have a fixed time, and that's when it's going to come off, then you're not makbid until that fixed time. That's the position. Like, yeah, it makes sense. Once you hear Rav Moshe say it, it makes a lot of sense. So that's the standard according to him. So to sum up what we've said about makbid and not makbid, number one, the standard is both objective and subjective. We're strict both ways. If most people are makbid, then it's an issue for you. If most people are not makbid, but you are makbid, it's an issue for you. However, we have three criteria which mitigate makbid. Number one, if you have an incentive to leave it on, then such as aesthetics, then we say that it's not makbid. Number two, where you couldn't remove it personally, then your desire to remove it is irrelevant. And number three, if there's a fixed date and time, you know, at some point in the future when it's going to be removed, you're not makbid until then. Those are three potential mitigating factors. The last point we have to get to before we can then bring this all together for practical cases is the question of, are there parts of the body where chatzitza is not an issue? What I called on your sheet, hidden areas of the body. Take a look, please, at source number 10, the first source we address in dealing with this. It talks about an arrow. No one you see should ever have an arrow stuck into their mouth, but you'll see why it's relevant. If an arrow is stabbed into somebody's flesh, you might argue he has other things to worry about than going to mikvah at that point. But nonetheless, the doctors decided it's embedded and they're not taking it out. So now you have to know, all right, what about going to mikvah? So, if an arrow is stabbed into the person's flesh, and it's visible, there's something poking out, then indeed it interrupts. Vim eino nira, but if it's not visible, then tova. You go to mikvah, and okay, so there's an arrow inside, but it's inside. This is what we call balua. It's absorbed in the person's body. The Shach, Rav Shabbosai Cohen, commenting on the Shulchan Aruch, explains that what we mean when we say it's not visible is that skin has actually grown over it. So it's entirely inside the body. The equivalent regarding teeth may be the inside of one's tooth. A horrific case that's discussed by the Minchas Yitzchak, Rav Yitzchak Weiss, is the case of a woman who I believe he's referring to during World War II, just based on what he describes. He describes a case in which a woman needed to hide some gem so that they'd be able to use it at some point to barter for their lives. And she had it put in a tooth with a crown on top. And her question was, what about mikvah now? So, two separate questions. One was the crown, but in terms of the gem itself inside the tooth, in the inside of the tooth is balua. It's entirely absorbed inside. There's no way that's ever exposed to the outside. That's one. Sorry?
Did that soaked Africa and Europe all the time?
Okay.
And also, and they couldn't take it.
Or like the chin, or you have like shrapnel, or in dentistry, you have amalgam tattoo of pieces of metal are left in the mouth, and it's not rinsed after the filling, and it gets under the skin. Stay there forever.
Correct. It comes up there. It comes up also in the temporary stages when you're working on an implant and you stitch something in the early stage under the gum. Right? So that's also called balua. So that you're right. That's one. And then number two, there's something called base hastarin. Beis Hasdarim, Beit Hasdarim means an area of the body that is hidden. If you take a look at source number 11 on your sheet, the Gemara in Nida that talks about this. Nehid bias hamayim lo ba'inan makom haroi lebias mayim ba'inan. We don't require that water get into base hastarim, hidden areas of the body. However, we require that it be suitable for water to enter. There shouldn't be any blockage, any obstruction in that space. Kid the Rabbi Zera, as Rabbi Zera taught an entirely different area of halacha. Rabbi Zera is talking about menachos. There are flower offerings that are brought in the Beis Hamikdash in the temple in Yerushalayim. Those flower offerings often have to be mixed with oil. The concern is that you have so much flour that within the kli, within the receptacle holding the flour, you won't be able to properly mix it such that the oil will get to the whole thing. So the rule is that if it's below a certain size, it is considered to be mixable, and even if it turns out the mixture wasn't perfect, that's okay. As long as it was mixable. It's called bila. In Hebrew, it was short for belila. Or another form of the word belila. On the other hand, if the ratio was such that, or the size was such, that it couldn't be mixed properly, then we're going to say that that it's no good. It's not going to be acceptable. So, applying that here, we say that if the Beit Hasdarim has a chatzitza inside, this hidden area has a chatzitza inside, so that water couldn't enter, then it's a problem. If water could enter, and it happens not to, you're okay, as long as water could have entered. So that brings us to the halacha brought in source number 12, where the Shulchan Aruch writes, Eina tzricha liftoach pia kedei sheikansu bahamayim. A woman need not open her mouth to such a point that the water could enter. Velo tikpots osa yoser midai, but she also shouldn't close it too tightly. Vim koftsa, if she did close it tightly, lo also la tvila, then the immersion did not work. The mouth is called a base hastarim, this hidden area of the body. There is some debate, and it matters for us, as to whether that standard of water should be able to enter is biblical or rabbinic. That's subject to debate. I brought you the sources here. I'm going to just gloss over it here, but I brought them on the sheet. Source number 13 is the view of Tosfos on the Gemara in Kiddushin. Tosfos claims that it's a biblical lesson that teaches it, because the pasuk says you wash your entire flesh in the water, and he has and his hands as part of it, but that seems to be, there's a difference in Tosfos' edition and our edition. The point is that he says the Torah says you should wash your entire flesh, so that means even the hidden parts have to have the possibility of being exposed to water. That's Tosfos' view. The Ritva, Rabbeinu Yom Tov El Ashbili, in source number 14, a rough contemporary of Tosfos a little bit later, disagreed and said, no, it's actually rabbinic. It's a rabbinic decree that the water has to be able to get in. The reason why this matters is because if it's a rabbinic requirement, there may be room for leniency, especially combining it with other grounds for leniencies. So these are things that we need to keep in mind here.
Who says it's rabbinical?
Sorry? The Ritva in source 14. Yeah. Teeth themselves appear not to be Beit Hasdarim, a hidden area of the body, because when you open your mouth, people see your teeth. That's not called a hidden area of the body. Some of us keep our mouths open more often than others, but nonetheless, the teeth are not considered to be Beit Hasdarim, but parts of the mouth might well be. You deal with it, for example, in terms of stitches. You could have stitches that are on the bottom inside the lip where no one is going to see them. That would be called a Beit Hasdarim. It comes up because the Gemara Nida talks about a woman in the house of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, who went to mikvah, but then she found that she had something between her teeth, and she went back to the mikvah a second time, because teeth are not called Beit Hasdarim. But the other parts of the mouth may well be. So, to sum up what we've said, and then we'll get to the practical applications. We've said that, number one, when you go to mikvah, you can't have a chatzitza, an interruption. We noted that at a certain point, something may be said to become part of the body that may be contingent on time, or it may be contingent on intent. Number two, we said that if you are makbid, or most people would be makbid, then something is a chatzitza, right? Biblically, if it covers most of the body. Rabbinically, if it does not cover most of the body. But we said that if you have an incentive to keep it in, or you can remove it professionally, or you have a set date on which it will be removed, then we would argue that you're not makbid because you're not looking to have it removed right now. And then the third point is, there are parts of the body where chatzitza is not an issue. If it's balua, if it's entirely absorbed beneath the surface, then water need not be able to enter, and it's fine. If it's beit hastarim, a hidden part of the body, water need not actually enter, but water must be able to enter, biblically or rabbinically. That's a summary of what we said for the previous 38 minutes. I hope that it, you know, helped. But now let's talk practically. Let's talk about actual cases in here. Please turn to the table on the third side. So the first case I want to talk about is the permanent tooth that's being put in. So here we distinguish a little bit between different types of teeth. I don't know how much of this is current technology at this point, so tell me if something that I'm mentioning is no longer used. But I have three different types, or really four different types of teeth to deal with. Number one, the basic tooth implant that's going to remain there forever. Number two, a tooth that gets removed for cleaning. Number three, a tooth that's removed for sleeping or for eating. And then the stages in putting in a tooth, the abutment and the post and so on, during the period when something is going to be implanted. So I'll go through those, and then let's ask questions that relate to those. So first, the permanent tooth that's being implanted. So this is discussed. The earliest source that everybody likes to quote on this is a sefer called Binas Adam. It's actually a commentary to the Chokmas Adam, which is written by the Chayei Adam. I mention that because the Chayei Adam tends to at least be familiar to some people. The latter, the other two are not. The Chayei Adam or Avram Danziger. I'm even mixing up with somebody else, but I think so. Wrote in the 19th century, that a false tooth is not chotzeitz, is not an interruption, because she wants to have it in. She wants the tooth in for no other reason than aesthetics. Forget chewing. People want to have the tooth remain in the mouth, and it's there permanently. And this is quoted by everybody on this. There are two reasons to argue the point, and that's what I brought on the grounds for stringency. One reason to argue is, well, you could get a removable one. And remember, I quoted you in the beginning. The Rama said, if you have the option of immersing without any chatzitza, lechatchila, ideally you should do that. So there is one source that argues that removal, you could have gotten a removable one. Nonetheless, we tend not to follow that view. The other argument is, well, what if she has many such false teeth? Does that become rove? And if it's rove, if it's the majority, because maybe we consider the mouth to be a separate unit, not measured against the rest of the body, so the majority of the mouth is false teeth, then maybe at that point, whether she's makbid or not, is no longer relevant. Nonetheless, the halachic authorities that I have seen say that a permanent tooth is not an issue, and she has no reason to have to opt for a removable tooth in order to take care of this. Yeah.
Can I just clarify, when you're a permanent tooth implant, you just mean a replacement, not an implant, because an implant means something goes in the bone. Talking about a crown, talking about a bridge.
Right, so I would actually, I come back to the crown and bridge a little bit later, but basically the same law is going to pertain. The same law will apply. I use the term permanent tooth implant, I think more for sophistication sounding than any, you know, in order for it to sound better than false tooth than anything else. But yes, the same rule will pertain when we get down to permanent crown and bridge. That's number one. Number two, a tooth that gets removed for cleaning. So many halachic authorities do make the argument that this is a chatzitza, that this is an interruption, because it's like the ring that you take off in order to knead dough. So you take this off from time to time in order to clean it. Others, though, are lenient. Number one, because we said you're not called makbid if you have an incentive to leave it in, and they say, well, you know, women generally will want their tooth left in. They don't like to walk around with a gap. Also, here's an interesting argument brought by a work called the Shari Tevila by Rabbi Chiel Michel Stern. He points out that there are two different reasons, two different classes of reasons to remove something. Sometimes you remove something because you don't want it in. Other times, though, you remove something because you want to make it fit better. You want to make it work better. It's not really removal at all. It's just, I'm adjusting it so that it'll stay in longer and in a better way. So a tooth that you remove for cleaning is really being removed in order to keep it in. Not as removal because I don't want it there anymore. And that's an argument that he presents for leniency. Not to mention, these removal may take place at long intervals, depending on the type of tooth you're talking about and the way it fits. So many are lenient regarding this. There are those who are strict and will say a tooth which is removed for cleaning should also be removed before going to mikvah. I don't know if I know the state of dentistry today. Is that still a situation where there will be teeth that are put in that are removed for cleaning? Okay, I don't know. I'm blessed. The only stuff I have to worry about is orthodonture at this stage.
I'm not sure the situation. Maybe somebody will help.
Sorry?
Yeah, I'm not sure the situation what it is, because if you're suggesting a removable appliance, there's some to say that you can leave it in for tefillah, which is news to me. If you're an actual removable appliance that comes out, that could come out regularly, yeah. Like a partial denture,
and other things.
That's aesthetic. Yeah. You might be able to leave it. I'm not sure what this would apply to this category. Okay. I can't think of a situation.
Well, remove
it on the retainer.
Yeah, retainer with the
teeth on it.
You can leave it
all.
Right?
That's a flipper.
Yeah,
you
can leave that for the mikvah.
No, I'm just saying, instead of taking it up tonight.
I'm just trying to find a situation where you're just explaining where you can leave it in for the mikvah. I can't think.
Right, but the answer is that there are those who argue that because it's aesthetic and you don't want to remove it, and because the removal that you do is only for maintenance purposes, they argue that it would not need to be removed. Even though it can be removed, even though it's not affixed to your body and so on, the halakhic criteria are satisfied.
Does it matter whether the patient can remove it themselves or whether they have to go to the dentist to have to remove
right.
it?
So yes, because we said under makbid that where you can't remove it yourself, it's much less likely that we're going to call this makbid. Yeah. Sorry? So that's the next one. Teeth that are removed for sleep or for eating. So there, we do say that it should be removed when one goes to mikvah. Because there, we really do view it as the equivalent of the ring that's removed for kneading dough.
Would aesthetics apply if there's no one to see that person except the mikvah?
Yes, because makbid is not necessarily about makbid at the time of mikvah. It's about makbid in general. Is it something that you remove in general when you're able to remove it? So something that you leave in because you like it there aesthetically, correct. It's about whether people would want it removed or not. I think most people in general who have teeth that are there for aesthetic reasons don't remove it the second they're out of sight. You know, they don't want to see themselves in the mirror without this.
But most take them out at night.
Right. So that's where we say if you're really going to remove it every night, then it does seem to be a concern, and we would say take it out before going to make. Yes.
Let's say we have the following scenario. The lady has a missing front tooth, so she wears a denture appliance. She doesn't want anybody in the community to know she's missing a front tooth. She can remove it. She never wants to remove it. She's been instructed to remove it, even to keep things clean. She never wants to remove it. And it is like the ring that she can remove the ring to leave the door. You have to remove the ring to leave the door. She said the only time she ever removes the ring. So here's a conflict because most people say, okay, we need to remove it in order to go to the mikvah, but she doesn't want to do that. She doesn't want anyone to see it.
So. Right. So here's where I fall back on my default statement that I'm not poskening, you know, for people, and you know that's what the shul rabbi has to do, because there what you're I'm very comfortable saying the weight of halachic opinions is such, but recognize that there are minority views on both sides, and if you had an extreme case where a woman was going to say, "I'm not going to mikvah if this is what I have to do," then I think it's time to ask a shaila and say, "So what do we do?" So that I wouldn't touch. The last question within this is the protective cap or the surgical packing in stages of tooth implants. When you're dealing with the implant, you know, the implant in the gum is not a problem. anything that's in the gum in any case is balua, and that which is implanted to stay becomes, as we said, batel to the body. It's now part of the body. That's not my concern. But as I understand it, and Rabbi Forst has a nice description of this in his Laws of Nida work, you put in the abutment, and then while you're waiting before you're going to put on the permanent tooth, you screw on a protective cap. Does that reflect what you're familiar with? A healing cap. Okay. So this healing cap is meant to be taken off. Right? You can eat with it on. You do eat with it on. But it's due for removal. And then you also have this surgical packing, which I gather is just a cushion. Is that what this is? The
burial cushion or just burial to protect it from bacteria and what?
Okay. Right. So there it would seem to be a problem. On the one hand, one eats with them. On the other hand, they're due for removal, and they're not going to be replaced. And what I mean by that is that we distinguish between where you have something, let's say a temporary filling, that you're going to remove, but it's going to be replaced by a permanent filling, so you intend for that spot to be covered always, whether it's this material or other material, and therefore we can argue it's not really makbid. Because even though you're going to remove this, you're still going to cover the spot. We distinguish between that and this case in which what you're going to replace it with is something entirely different.
But there's a guided food process.
Understood.
It's part of the process.
Let me ask you a question.
Just like a temporary.
This is right.
It's a short tooth instead of a full.
Right, I mean it's the donut you put on before you get to get a real tire, right? After you have a flat. Put it in my terms, not big dentists.
The healing cap really has permanency because there's cases, as I experience, where patients don't want to take it to the next level, and in most times these healing caps have to be done by a professional because they're torqued, they're screwed on, not just some patients take some kind of thing.
So you can't remove that yourself.
Most times, you need a special driver, a special kind of instrument to loosen it. So patients have been known to wear these things for years. And
really? That's very interesting.
Yeah, that's not
very different than burial pack.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talking about the dressing is very different because nobody keeps that in there for years. That's not the very place.
And most times, they don't use the treatment plan. They don't use the cap.
So, a couple of thoughts here. Number one, the question of whether you are able to remove it or whether you need to go back to the dentist, I think, is a relevant question here. Number two, it's important to remember that we may well distinguish between one type of healing cap or one type of patient and another. You know, the patient who says, I'm never removing this, and this is just what I'm going to now have for years and years, is different from the patient who has the healing cap on and is planning on getting it removed next month or in 2 months or whatever it is when they can have the new tooth put on. So it's not a one-size-fits-all answer. This is an area where it is a gray area. Some of it will depend on how long the delay will be in going to mikvah. Because sometimes the poskim, the halachic authorities, will look at this and say, you know what? Since there are many authorities who say you should not go to mikvah with this, and since you can get this thing removed next week, better to wait a week and just go to mikvah after that. It depends a lot on the... even though we don't take delaying mikvah lightly, sometimes in some circumstances we're going to say, better to wait. So it really is going to be dependent on the particular situation. Ellie and then Harold.
What about surgical stitches?
Coming to them. Oh, you know what? I didn't put it on the table. But remind me at the end if I don't say it, because I have it here in my notes.
Is it tattoo in any part of the body? Not just the mouth? What's it?
A tattoo. Would a tattoo be chotis?
How many people have tattoos? They don't get
it. Yeah, no, that's true. My general understanding is that it's not a chatzitza.
I think it's been a problem.
Yeah.
Like if someone has a tattoo, like, yeah, I think you know that person also, and it's something that they don't believe in anymore.
Right.
It's like something that's bad, and they don't want it there, so then it is a problem. Someone has to go get a tattoo removed before they
really remove it. I think they just scar the skin so you can't see it. It's
interesting.
Yeah.
Right. So that's something that I'd have to discuss. I'm not answering the tattoo question right now. Understood. I can follow up with this. Everyone has signed in and given me their emails, so I can follow up about the tattoo. I'm not going into the henna thing because we have dental things we still need to do. We get to fillings, okay? Fillings, permanent fillings. So when you're dealing with a permanent filling, there have been those who argued to be strict historically. One argument was that you don't really want it there. This is a classic. This comes from that work from Avraham Danziger, the Binas Adam. He argued, this goes back almost two centuries, that one doesn't really want it there, but he only needs it medically. However, in the Shari Tvila, Rabbi Chiya Michal Stern noted that this could be a matter of old medicine. I'm sorry, the Nishmas Avram, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Avram is one who notes this. The Chochmas Adam, writing 200 years ago, is dealing with very different technology. He's dealing with a situation in which what they were using to fill the tooth actually was not very good and would disturb the person and potentially cause problems when eating and so on. Today, a person gets a permanent filling, they don't think twice about it anymore. If you asked me which teeth of mine have permanent fillings, I couldn't tell you without looking in a mirror. Realistically, that is not said to be a concern today. Further, you have no way to remove it yourself. You have no option for removing your own filling. On the other hand, there are many reasons to be lenient. Number one, you want it there. You actively want it there to fill the hole. Number two, it's beit hastarim, because it's not the visible part of the tooth. This space, even the part of the top where you can see the filling, it's a minority of the space. It's the miut. Removing it would require an expert. Lots of luck trying to remove your permanent filling. And you chew just fine with it. It doesn't disturb anything. So the general understanding is that a permanent filling is not going to be an issue at all. There is some discussion about where the filling protrudes from the tooth. Or Shlomo Kluger, in his work Meinida, wanted to make sure that it would not protrude from the tooth. But other halachic authorities disagree and say that's not a problem. The reason he required it, in a nutshell, is because he compared it to the arrow that's stuck into the skin, where we said if it protrudes, then it's going to be a problem. But the argument against him is that the reason why the arrow protruding from the skin is a problem is because when an arrow protrudes from skin, some skin is drawn in to the hole where the arrow is, and water won't get there. When something protrudes from a tooth, no part of the enamel or the external surface of the tooth is going to be drawn in to the hole where this filling is protruding. So there's no issue of, hey, water should have gotten in there and now it can't. So that the general assumption is that assuming that the protrusion does not disturb, you're okay. Assuming the protrusion does not disturb, it's going to be okay. This is also quoted regarding pieces of cement that are left over from dental work. What if dental work was done and a little bit of cement is still there and stuck to a tooth, and maybe over time it'll fall off. So we also assume that that's not a problem, assuming it's not disturbing you such that you're not makbid.
What about a splinter or a thorn in practical terms? Somebody gets a splinter.
So if it's not a dental question, I'm going to hold off right now because we're getting to the 1 hour point in a couple of minutes. Temporary fillings. So on the one hand, you'll argue it's not meant to remain in, and therefore it's a chatzitza. On the other hand, number one, it's beit hastarim. Again, it's in this area that people can't see. Number two, and therefore the requirement for water to be able to enter may be a rabbinic requirement, according to that ritva. Number two, it's miut, it's minority of the space. Number three, even though it's going to be removed, it's going to be replaced by a permanent filling. So it's not as though you want this thing removed. You want the spot exposed. You don't. You intend for it to be filled in. Other halachic authorities say it's like a scab, where even though it'll eventually come off, right now removing the scab would cause pain and damage your healing process. So, the temporary filling, which was sometimes, as Dr. Savovich mentioned, will even have medication on it or some kind of an anesthetic on it that you actually want to have in there. Not to mention, there's a set time for its removal and you need an expert to remove it and so on. So, in practice, the halachic authorities tend to be fine with it, but ask the rabbi, because there are those who are strict depending on how long it's going to be in. So there is room to question that. The
length of time might play a factor in the Rob's decision.
Correct.
I think, personally, I know I've been asked, I think a lot of it, the temporary filling, is the value or what it's meant to do. If a treatment is done, and basically it's either a time factor or something where it has, you know, basically to seal the area, but it's not a healing process, it's not a strength, it may be potentially maybe slightly strengthening process, but it's going to be taken out, like you, I don't want to say an endo, or a certain type of thing where it's done, and you need to, you don't want to go ahead with a permanent filling, so you just seal it up. Whereas that, you're worried about the nerve that's going to be, is going to heal or not, and it has value to it.
Right.
That could be a question.
Correct.
With that temporary filling.
Correct. The goal of having it there may well matter.
I have a hard time understanding. You mentioned the water has to go in.
The water has to be able to go in. It has to be possible for water to enter.
Open your mouth, the water goes and it covers your teeth.
Right. The question is the space where the temporary filling occupies. Will I view that as balua? Will I view that as base hastarm? How am I going to look at it? That's part of the question.
Water doesn't normally go in.
Correct.
Into a tooth.
But on the other hand, before you put the temporary filling in, there is a hole there. The water has access to the space.
So
now I'm blocking it.
You have a hole. The water is going in.
Correct. And now I'm blocking the access.
Yeah, but the natural state of the body.
That's so that's the argument and response. I mean, this is a debate back and forth. This is a debate back and forth, and we can argue it out here too.
You know, but I'm having a problem understanding the basic concept of, you know, on one hand you had a quote where, you know, hair that's been dyed, you know, is not an issue, and how could a filling be an issue?
Like a veneer, it's a powder.
It's like no, I mean, and it's in a place that's, you know, against hair that's openly
right, and
how can you make any argument for any stringency on anything that's in the mouth?
Because the argument would be that the hair dye is something people actively put in because they like the way it looks, whereas the temporary filling is viewed as a necessary evil.
People put veneers on for the same reason; they cover the teeth.
Right, and the veneer. Sorry.
The veneer is permanent.
Right, this is something that's temporary that, in fact, you're going to remove because you want to put something permanent there.
But it's the same process. It's a
dye is permanent. Though.
What if a woman dyes her hair?
Comes out, the dye wears
out.
Right. No. So this is actually a good question because I want to. I'm going to take a second for this because it comes up in the discussions. The question of what if you change your mind. You have something that you thought was permanent, but then you changed your mind. As long as you thought it was permanent at the time of the trip to the mikvah, that's good enough, even if you change your mind later. I say that because some of those who write on this make a very interesting suggestion, which I think could be a malpractice issue. So be very careful not to do this, or at least think carefully before you do it. But they recommend that a dentist who knows that this is an issue for the woman in terms of her trip to the mikvah, tell the husband that you should know she's going to be able to remove this in a few weeks, but tell her that it's not going to be removed. And that way, when she goes to mikvah, she's not makbid because she thinks that it's going to stay in, and only afterwards is it going to... Like I said, be very careful about this. But they do mention it. Yes. I'm not recommending this. Okay. I want to go further to the crowns and bridges and braces and the stitches. There's more to discuss. And if anyone needs to leave early, by the way, in the follow-up email that I'll send out, I will send a link to the audio online because it's really not... If you're leaving at this point, it's not early. Okay. Crowns and bridges. So they follow pretty much what we said regarding the fillings, as I mentioned before. If they are permanent, they are not viewed as a chatzitza. They're viewed as an attachment to the body. The one note that is made is that for a bridge, you're going to have to be careful, just like with teeth, to clean out anything that develops and gets caught, because you have to do that anyway before going to the mikvah. But those are fine. And even if it's temporary, since you need a craftsman to remove it, you need a dentist to remove it, and it's there for beauty purposes, and it's not removed until a specific time, so halachic authorities tend to treat it as a non-chatzitza. They tend to treat it as okay, and it would not need any removal. The temporary crown would be fine. Braces are the big headache, or the danger is where the problems really come in. the brackets themselves may be considered to be part of the tooth because they're attached with cement, because they're meant to remain there sometimes for years, because you can't remove it yourself and it's only going to be removed by a craftsman at a specific time with specific equipment and so on. The brackets tend not to be the problem. The wires tend to be the problem. Now, they discuss two different types of wires, one of which I must confess was entirely new to me. They talk about wires that are used to straighten teeth, and that's what I'm familiar with, but they also talk about having orthodonture that's intended to keep the teeth in, that you would actually use the wires to...
Rip-on.
Oh, is that what that is? Okay, yeah, it's a splint. Okay.
If you lose bone, the teeth are wiggly.
Yeah, so they'll use braces?
A piece of wire or something bonds it into place perfectly.
Got it. Okay. So where it's to strengthen the teeth... There are reasons that are brought to be strict.
So without the wires, brackets are just placement. You need wires that are necessary. The wires are the ones that...
Correct. Brackets. I'm going to come back to that point. Hang on.
If the water can go under, the wires
not
under.
It's not hugging the tooth. It's sticking out.
Correct. So let me just walk you through the discussion. Where the wires are there to strengthen the teeth, to straighten the teeth, I should say, there are a few reasons that are brought to be strict. One reason that's brought is that you can't argue that these are beautiful. They're, even though they have the nice colored rubber bands for kids now and all that, nonetheless, the effect will be beautification of the person, but no one keeps them in thinking, I look great because I have braces. That's not the norm. Number two, people generally don't want them and do it as a concession. They will remove them as soon as you say they can come off. They'll be in your office that day in order to get rid of them. Number three, a greater concern nowadays is that the wires are actually held in place by elastic bands that are changed monthly. It tends to be something that, or if not monthly, it's every couple of months. But you have these appointments where things are changed. So if any of the wire or the band would be blocking the water from getting to the skin, to the tooth, whatever, then you would have a problem. On the other hand, as is noted, the wires tend to have room for the water to get around. The wires often will not block anything from getting to the teeth. I think it depends on the placement of the wire.
Well, that's not...
Yeah.
If you're saying the bracket's not an issue because the bracket is permanently attached, it cannot be removed, so therefore it's not a chassid. So what is the status of the bracket? Because the wire will stay against the bracket and prevent water from getting to the bracket. So it's essentially a chassid on the bracket now.
That's interesting, because the bracket is now part of the tooth, therefore the bracket now has to be close to water.
That will be an issue with the wire against the
bracket. I hadn't thought about that, but I hear the argument.
What was the question?
The question is, if
the bracket... The tooth, the wire is a chassid to the bracket, and the wire is changed monthly.
Yeah, but the bracket is not part of the regular form of the tooth. It's, what we said before, it's sticking out of the surface.
That's true, but if the reason why the bracket is okay and not a problem is because it's said to be part of the tooth, then now the bracket has to be exposed to water.
For 2 years, the bracket is now part of the body.
I hadn't thought about that, but I definitely hear the argument.
Well, why can't you extend it a little further and say that the bracket is stuck on with strong cement and the wires are stuck on with a little less adhesive, a rubber band?
Yeah.
So it's all one.
Because it's not.
Because the wires are not.
The wires
are thrown out.
Right.
Pardon me. The wires are looped monthly and thrown out.
I don't think so. I'm not an orthodontist, but don't they just bend them?
All the questions can be thrown out right away. You can use the same wire for 9 months.
Do you adjust it at all in the 9 month time?
Yeah.
What does adjusting look like?
Adjusting the wires, like either bending the wire or changing things that are attached to the brace, and the wire functions as a guide to where the teeth go. I did have a patient where I had to remove the wire every time.
Interesting.
The wire, not the braces, the wire.
That's very interesting. I'm going to come back to that. It goes back to Larry's point about braces, about brackets without wires.
I'm here to gather information, you're not busking, so I'm certainly not busking, but I want to know what to tell people.
Right.
What
so Invisalign wouldn't be a problem.
Right.
Invisalign would not be a problem.
Invisalign is a huge problem, but well, I don't think there's time.
I don't know what Invisalign is, so let's come back to that. I want to know what Invisalign is.
Shh. then the wire becomes part of the bracket.
The braces are removed, right? And
then the bonded retainer.
Bonded retainer means what?
It's a wire that's
glued in. It's a wire that's
left in. Oh, perfect.
Well, see, now they can take out their teeth, apparently. Oh, those are Hudson's too.
That's the wire.
There. So, okay, so what I'm looking at here is a wire running behind the front teeth. And it's bonded to the teeth with what looks like some kind of a glue. Is that normally the way it would be?
That's
permanent? So, my gut, and again, I didn't look into this beforehand, my gut would be that it's because it's permanent, number one, because it's part of the healing purpose in the sense that it's there to keep this, it's like you want to keep in. If it ever came out, you'd have a problem and you'd want to go to a doctor to get it taken care of. And because it's base hastarim, because it's the area behind the teeth. It's not visible to people, so that you need water to be able to enter.
Some guys put it on there
is a problem.
Then I could see grounds for saying this was fine, but I want to look into it.
I've never had it decided. Well, some people have a preference for it now, but I've never really gotten the application. For most post control, that's fine.
Interesting. There is an issue with this.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the argument that we had with the tooth also, because you could put in a removal bond. Interesting.
There is a problem with this type that it develops very commonly.
Yeah.
Harder couches because it's built up.
Yeah.
Which is a foreign body which people don't want in there. And with that type of bond, very often it does accumulate this harder buildup. And is that considered then a chatzitza? Because it is, it's not allowing these water.
Before you answer there you can ask a general question, forget the orthodontic part, just because some of those other teeth clean.
That's right.
That's why it's hard to build up.
Is that a chatzitza in the
bone? Right.
So go hand in hand with the calcium tartar build.
Right. So the question was asked. The question was asked, what about calculus, tartar, and so on? Whatever term you're gonna put on it to a layman. So I did look into it, and the general rule is that one who goes to mikvah is expected to brush normally and get out whatever they can get out. And whatever they're not able to remove through the normal process of cleaning their teeth, brush, floss, whatever, is there and remains there until their next dental appointment and is not considered to be a problem. Even if there's additional buildup because of the... Correct. No, correct. It's what's normal. It's normally there.
So we'd like you to pass the Rabbi Hachina that all from dental patients should see their dentist every month. Yeah, not every 6 months. That's
right.
What we need to hear.
Right.
We're all retired here.
So, wires to keep teeth in with the splint situation that you're describing. So Moshe Feinstein contends you could argue that this is what we called revise. This is considered to be the way the teeth grow, much like those hairs that you would never unstick from itself. As long as it doesn't disturb your eating. The Shari Tevila of Rabbi Chil Michel Stern wants to compare it to a bandage on a wound, which you must keep on the wound, and removing it would actually damage the healing effect, and especially because this is ultimately a miut, it's the minority of the surface, and because it's something that you intend to leave there, you do not intend to remove it, you would need a professional to remove it, and so on, there is greater grounds for leniency when dealing with wires that are there in order to keep the teeth when you're dealing with a splint situation. But here you definitely need to ask the rabbi, particularly because there are additional complicating factors. One point which Larry mentioned is one might be tempted to say, so remove the wires before you go in. And I understand that you actually had a situation like that where the statement was, remove the wires. But others argue that if you remove the wires, it renders the brackets useless, and therefore we'll say someone is makbid. No one wants to walk around with brackets attached to their teeth. Just because they go having brackets on. So that actually, according to some halachic authorities, will make things worse rather than better. So that's something to consider. There are also other chatzitza issues that come up when you're dealing with braces. The wax on the edges of the wires to keep it from scratching the inside of your cheek and so on. So the braces issue is very complicated and really requires a specific psak. It's not straightforward. I do know that there are those who will say a woman who's of age to be going to the mikvah simply shouldn't get braces. Like they'll simply say flat that it shouldn't be done and wait, if you're able to wait. There are lenient views as well. The Nishmas Avram, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Avraham, in his Nishmas Avram, brings lenient views regarding braces, but it's not a simple and straightforward thing. It requires serious psak. The last item that I'll mention is the stitches question, just because it was asked. I forgot to put it in the... I didn't put it in the table. So where they are dissolving stitches, Rav Chaim Michal Shtern in his Shari Tevila says it's not an issue if they are dissolving stitches, especially because it's inside, especially if it's in a part that you can't see from the outside. It becomes part of the body, and that's all it is. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was even lenient for dissolving stitches that are on the skin. Forget something that's inside the mouth where it's not seen, but even on the skin, he felt it becomes a part of your body, and that's that. No one's going to do anything to remove it. I'm sorry?
Not like an arrow
sticking out. No, he seemed to feel that it was fine.
Center. Even if it's not dissolving, the water's going right. Its stitches are not so tight that you can't. Water can slide under.
Right, so where they're going to be removed, we do find a debate. In terms of the practical reality, if it's true that the water can get to all parts of the skin there, then I agree, you're done. You don't have any question. But in the event that they can't, then I don't know. I'm not familiar enough with the with what's used. But there are those who are lenient. There are those who are lenient, especially if it's not in a spot that is visible. The Nishmas Avram brings views that are lenient. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said, generally speaking, removable stitches are removed in a short period of time, and therefore he felt better to wait with the immersion rather than go to mikvah with these stitches that are in. But it is subject to some debate when it's a set of stitches that are actually going to be removed as opposed to stitches that will dissolve. So I have for homework for myself, and I want to follow up with you, the Invisalign case, which I don't know about, and as well as the discussion about the bonded retainer. I want to see what I can find about both of those, and come back to you with it. Question, yes.
The question. So what do I tell a patient who comes in, needs a temporary crown, it's a crown, temporary crown, because many of them have told me in the past that their rabbis say they have to fit it into the period where they, can have it done. So what's my...
So
generally I tell every from patient, check with your rabbi or do it during that period of time, but occasionally a crown doesn't fit so well and you got to send it back to the laboratory and say, I got to have it in by Thursday. It's like,
Right. So the answer would be that if you're dealing with a patient who has already asked their rabbi, then they asked their rabbi, and there really isn't anything else for you to say. The rabbi gave them the answer. But if it's somebody who hasn't yet asked, right, I think it's good to advise them to ask, because many poskim are lenient with a temporary crown.
Right.
So I wouldn't want them to now lose out and not ask their rabbi.
I don't want to make them suck on them.
No, you don't make them suck, but you let them know that that many are lenient, so they should really find out.
Sometimes people do an extraction, and a piece of root is left in, and sometimes it's sticking out of the gum a little bit. So that's like the arrow case. It's half in and half out.
Mm-hmm. No, but the argument here is that it draws in some of the gum around it, potentially. If I accept the view, and I want to come back to your point about the patients, I had another thought on the temporary crown case. But if you take the view that the reason why the arrow is a problem is because it draws skin around it, and then water won't get through that area, then that may not work. That may not apply, I should say, in the stitch case. because it's not going to draw anything, any skin around it.
In the case of stitches, if there's a stitch and there's the external skin.
You know, hold on, because I want to make sure to answer this before people leave. To add my note on the temporary crown, don't say to the patient, please don't say to the patient, many are lenient. So you can say to them, some are lenient, because I don't want to prejudice the patient who then goes to the rabbi and the rabbi says not to be lenient. That would not be appropriate.
In the case of a stitch, right?
Yeah.
There's the external skin and he is sewed up, and then there's the, we'll call it the flesh internally, the meat. Right? So what is the principle that the water has to cover all of the skin? And you're saying if the skin puckers internally, then the water won't be able to get into the external skin.
Right, that's correct.
But the water doesn't have to bathe the flesh under the cut.
Correct.
In the cut. So when we talk about the skin or the mucous membrane in the mouth, it's not the same thing we're talking about when we talk about skin on the surface of the body.
Why isn't it? What do you mean by it?
Well,
it isn't because the materials are different? Or are you saying it shouldn't be the same from a halachic perspective?
How far do you go?
Well, let's say take the lips. The borders of the lips are one thing, but inside the mouth, there's clearly a change in the nature of the skin.
Right. So, right. From the standpoint of do I need to have it exposed to water? The answer is yes. The question of physically will it be drawn in?
Right, but which? My question is, which part of the body needs to become what?
The external skin coating. Whatever that is.
Nice or not correct?
Well, there are different sorts. There's the attached to the
skin. So where do you draw the line?
Right. And
well, the vermilion border of the lip, maybe? Is that where you draw the line? Where
no, but what I'm saying is that that anything there, in other words, virus stitch here, that should be exposed to water. That should be exposed to water. Yeah, that's what we'll call the base hastarim, that part of the body that is normally hidden, and therefore water should be able to enter, but not that water must enter. But water should be able to enter. That's what I'm saying.
Rabbi, something like a piercing of the tongue or the floor of the mouth.
That's interesting.
They're very difficult to remove. You need a
really?
Professional.
Yeah? I don't know. I know nothing about this.
Yeah.
No, the trick, when the floor of the mouth.
Had a girl, she's
upset. All right, I'd have to look into that. I didn't even think of that one. I can't imagine why I didn't think of that.
I might get together with the times.
Floor of the mouth?
A lot more mice.
All right.
The question is, are these